Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today we're going to explore the traditions of Kurdish women. We'll be drawing from ethnographic reports, various research, basically trying to get a handle on it all.
Yeah, and it's a huge topic. The goal really is to understand, you know, the many sides of Kurdish womanhood across history and different communities in Kurdistan.
Exactly. We want to unpack the main themes, the nuances, without getting totally lost in the details, but still connecting those dots.
And what strikes you immediately is just how varied it all is. It's not one single picture, right?
Not at all.
It's this incredibly rich tapestry woven from geography, religion, centuries of history, differing across all the Kurdish regions.
Right. So let's start with the social side, the family roles. We should look at the traditional family structures and the role of the Kabani, the female head of the household.
The Kabani, very important figure.
And then maybe think about gender dynamics historically. You know, times when women might have had more freedom, but also those persistent patriarchal controls.
Sure. And how things have shifted, maybe, with modernity and political movements coming into play.
Okay, so that traditional family, the patrilineal structure, male authority, that seems pretty common across the board.
It is a common thread, yes. But the Kabani adds, well, an interesting layer. Her authority is usually within the home, managing the household, the mal.
Right.
But that role was absolutely crucial for the family to even function. So you have to wonder, how did that domestic power maybe subtly shape things beyond the house itself?
That's a good question. How did women navigate that when their influence was mostly confined to the home? Some sources mention things like indirect methods, social withdrawal, maybe, as a way to gain leverage.
Yeah, and it seems like in some, particularly the semi-nomadic tribal groups where women contributed more economically, that might have meant more autonomy for them.
Interesting. So an economic link, potentially?
Potentially. And then think about urbanization. As people moved to cities, women started getting into wage labor. There's some suggestion that maybe the old patriarchal control started to weaken a bit then.
Leading to, perhaps, a stronger voice within the household.
It could point that way, yeah. A link between economic roles and shifts in those gender dynamics.
Okay. Then let's get into the major life moments. The rites of passage. Birth traditions first, like the symbolic things they do with the umbilical cord and that seventh night celebration.
Mm-hmm.
Then marriage customs. Everything from the courtship, the exequy's genie, through the actual wedding, and the whole economic side, the bride price, naxt or kulin, and the dowry, chies.
And those practices like levirate and sororate marriage, too. We should probably touch on those.
Good point. And finally, death and mourning. That tradition of cutting hair, poor Kerr, seems very powerful. And how women's roles in funerals might be changing today.
Okay, starting with birth. Those umbilical cord rituals are really quite telling, aren't they?
How so?
Well, just where it's placed. Maybe in a sewing machine drawer for a girl, or near school for a boy. It sounds simple, but it speaks volumes about gendered expectations right from the start.
Wow, yeah. It's like setting a path non-verbally.
Exactly. It shapes the child's perceived future from day one.
It really shows how deep those gender roles can run. And the seventh night party, that communal welcome for the baby, family, neighbors.
Often with music, dancing, women playing a central role. It underlines the community's joy, their investment in this new life.
And for Muslim families, you'd have Islamic birthrights woven in too, bringing the child into the religious community as well.
Right. Then moving to marriage, the eswa's genie, that formal courtship process, it involves the family elders, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Which really highlights marriage as more than just two people. It's a family union.
Absolutely. Even the small customs, like the potential bride serving water, it's all part of the observation, the assessment between families.
Okay, let's think about bride price. That economic exchange, it acknowledges the bride's value, sort of, but traditionally she didn't get it directly, did she?
No, often it went towards helping her brothers get married later. So it really frames marriage as part of a bigger family strategy.
And the dowry, the sehez that her family prepares.
It wasn't just practical stuff for the new home. It was also a reflection of her family's social standing, their status.
Makes sense. And those levirate and sororate marriage traditions, marrying a deceased spouse's sibling.
They might seem odd to us now, but they served a purpose, didn't they? Maintaining family ties, supporting widows or widowers, again, highlighting that communal aspect of marriage in traditional society.
Okay, let's shift gears to cultural expressions. Clothing first. Traditional clothes, adornments. The kraz is key, right? and how styles vary so much by region.
Oh, absolutely. The vibrancy is amazing, and the regional differences in the cross, the cut, the colors, the vests or jackets worn with it. It's like a visual language.
Tells you where someone's from.
Often, yes. And it's not just about looks, is it? Political decisions, historical events have impacted these clothes, like bans on traditional dress sometimes.
Right. It reminds you that something personal like clothing can get tangled up in big cultural and political forces.
Definitely. Then there are the crafts. Kurdish women's weaving, especially those rugs, glimsless, and leh rugs, they're famous worldwide.
And the fact that those complex patterns are often improvised, that speaks to a really deep artistic tradition passed down generation after generation.
Mm-hmm. They weren't just useful objects. They were and still are real artistic expression.
And it's not just weaving. Other crafts, too, using local stuff. It shows resourcefulness, a connection to the land, like the clash footwear, felt making.
It's a tangible link between the culture and the environment, yeah.
Huh. Okay, what about music and dance? That seems very communal.
It really is. The fact that men and women often dance together, like in the halay or govan, holding hands, linked arms, that's maybe different from some other cultures nearby.
Interesting point. It suggests a particular kind of social dynamic in those moments of, you know, celebration and togetherness.
Yeah, and while some dances might have specific steps for men or women, the overall participation points to a shared cultural experience. And it's not just celebration. These dances can mean unity, cultural survival, too.
And women singers. Yeah. Strenbej. Their role seems vital for keeping oral traditions alive, sharing stories and song.
Hugely important. Now, the term Dengbej often refers to the male epic singers, right? But Zarbej women were crucial in creating and passing on lots of other oral stories, often maybe more in domestic settings because of how society was structured.
So, potentially a whole lot of female storytelling that wasn't always recognized in the same way as the big public male performances.
That's a real possibility, yeah. An underrepresentation, perhaps. And when you look at Kurdish proverbs, the way women are portrayed, it's complex, sometimes contradictory even.
Suggesting society was kind of constantly working through negotiating female roles.
That's likely. And the women in folklore, epic figures like Zin from Memuz and the Tragic Heroine, or Edule from Dervish Ebdeeb, very determined, and Shamarin, the mythical snake queen.
Powerful figures.
Definitely. They offer these rich archetypes reflecting different sides of Kurdish womanhood, strength, love, wisdom. They feed into that cultural narrative.
All right, let's move into the diverse religious and spiritual traditions, how they influence women's practices. We've got Kurdish Muslim women, their role in mosques, Maulid traditions, Sufism, even scholars like Fikr Nisa, Shuda Baghdadiya, then Yazidi or Ezidi women, their active roles in rituals, festivals, the pilgrimage to Lalish, to Wozgran, and how things have changed after ISIS.
A very important point, the post-ISIS adaptations.
Then your Sani women, Alehak or Kakai, their role in Jankana ceremonies, and the figure of Katuni Resbar.
Right.
Then a Levi women, Rea Heki. Their idea of genderless souls participating together in sem ceremonies, the spiritual role of the Ana.
And finally, maybe touching on that ancient mother goddess figure, Ana or Anahita, and her lingering influence. Plus the role of women in Newroz celebrations today, which can be very vibrant and political. Okay, so that religious diversity is key. For Muslim Kurdish women, historically, access to formal religious schooling might have been different than for men, but knowledge was still passed down informally, right? Within families, often led by older women.
That makes sense.
And finding influential female Islamic scholars in history really pushes back against any idea that religious authority was only male.
Definitely. And then look at Yazidi women. Their active part in major rituals, festivals like Sursal, the huge pilgrimage to Lalish. It shows how central they are to the community's religious life.
Absolutely. And even facing the horror of the ISIS genocide, the way the Yazidi community adapted traditions to welcome back survivors, that shows incredible resilience and a rethinking of older practices.
A painful necessity. Mm. Now, Yersinism. Women's direct role in the main jam ceremonies might be limited, you say?
Generally, yes. But the reverence they have for female figures in their cosmology, like Katuni Resbar, shows the spiritual weight given to women in their beliefs.
Okay. And Elevism, that core idea of genderless souls that must impact women's roles.
It does, significantly. Participating side by side in semen ceremonies, the possibility for women to become a respected anime, it points towards a more egalitarian spiritual leadership, in principle at least.
And finally, that ancient mother goddess figure, Ana or Anahita. Her influence seems to echo across different Kurdish faiths.
It's fascinating, yeah. She's linked to life-giving elements, water, fertility. You see echoes of her in various rituals and revered female figures. It suggests this really deep layer of female spiritual importance that maybe predates some of the later religions.
And connects to today, like women in New Rose.
Exactly. Women's very visible, often politically charged role in New Rose celebrations now connects back to those ancient roots. But it's also very much about today's struggles and identity.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roj Bosch Hannah.
Ah, welcome, Hannah. Perfect timing.
Let's see. Takes a sip. It's got a good warmth to it today, but it's definitely on the bitter side.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Needs a good spoonful of sugar to really hit the spot. But that initial warmth is certainly welcome on a day like today.
Yes, a little sweetness can make all the difference. A moment for chai is always good.
Okay, that's much better. Welcome back, everyone. Now let's move on to tracing some historical lines, highlighting influential Kurdish women from earlier times right up to, well, today.
It's quite something, isn't it? Even going way back. In periods you'd assume were completely dominated by patriarchal norms, you find these Kurdish women who achieved real power and influence.
Like who?
Well, historical records mention women ruling principalities, leading tribes, contributing intellectually. Think of Lady Adela Jaff in the 19th century. Her leadership in Halabja was quite well known.
Right. And it wasn't just politics or ruling. What about intellectual figures?
Absolutely. Asenath Barzani, back in the 17th century, a famous Talmudic scholar. Or Mestra Ardalan, 19th century poet and historian. She was apparently the first female historian published in Iran.
Wow. So these examples really counter any simple idea of women just being passive figures in Kurdish history.
Completely. Then you move into the 20th, 21st centuries, and you see women increasingly right at the front of political activism, even armed struggle sometimes.
Figures like Leyla Zana, Sakin Kansaiz, Leyla Kasim.
Exactly. They became incredibly powerful symbols of resistance, the fight for Kurdish rights. Their actions resonated deeply.
And that continues today, doesn't it? Contemporary figures.
For sure. You have ongoing feminist activism, like from Huzan Mahmood, and artists like Haif Karaman, whose work explores identity and resistance in really powerful ways. Just the fact that we recognize these contemporary women as legendary shows that enduring tradition of honoring influential women.
But alongside these inspiring stories, we have to acknowledge the challenges, right? They haven't gone away.
No, absolutely not. It's crucial. Issues like gender-based violence are persistent and often made worse by conflict, by displacement. These are harsh realities.
That's true. But facing those challenges, this story is also one of resilience, isn't it? Of activism.
Definitely. The rise of women's organizations, that powerful slogan, Jin, Jian, Azadi, Woman, Life, Freedom.
You hear it everywhere now.
It shows this continuous fight for equality, for liberation, often tied directly to the broader struggle for Kurdish national rights. And the philosophy of genealogy, which came out of the Kurdish women's movement.
Explain that a bit.
Well, it's a unique feminist viewpoint, really. It puts women's liberation right at the center, arguing it's essential for changing society as a whole.
Interesting. And what about women outside Kurdistan, in the diaspora?
Their role is huge, too. Often, women in the diaspora become really key figures in keeping the culture alive, advocating for Kurdish rights abroad. They're forging new ways of being Kurdish women in different contexts.
So when you pull it all together,
yeah,
what's the big picture, the story of Kurdish women's traditions? Seems to be about incredible strength, finding ways to act, constantly dealing with societal rules. Both in Kurdistan and elsewhere.
I think that's right. Resilience, agency, negotiating norms. From those historical accounts of leaders and scholars to the vibrant cultural expressions, the active spiritual life, Kurdish women have always been shaping their communities.
Yeah.
And the more recent rise of women in politics, the development of ideas like genealogy, it shows this is a dynamic story still unfolding.
So as we wrap this up, it's clear these traditions are anything but static. They're this living, evolving tapestry.
Exactly.
We've seen how those deep-rooted patriarchal structures have existed alongside, well, amazing female agency, resilience, this constant push for influence, for equality.
Yeah, from historical leadership and scholarship through culture, religion, women have consistently left their mark.
And the last century or so brought huge changes. Women moving to the forefront of political movements, armed struggle even, challenging old norms, making new paths.
That philosophy of genealogy, the cry of Jin, Jian, Azadi, they really tie together the fight for national freedom and gender freedom. And despite all the ongoing problems, conflict, displacement, the resilience, the transformative power of Kurdish women, both at home and in the diaspora, keeps reshaping what it means to be a Kurdish woman today.
It's that mix, isn't it? Tradition and modernity. Ancient beliefs living alongside newer faiths, adapted faiths, and this incredible spirit of resistance, creativity. It paints a really rich, complex picture.
It really does.
And maybe it leaves you, the listener, thinking about this. How do deeply held traditions manage to both constrain and empower people, communities? And how vital is adaptation for those traditions to survive and stay relevant in a world that changes so fast?